KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, January 16, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speakers will be Omaha World Herald columnists Mike Kelly and Rainbow Rowell. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Hugh Cowden, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Good afternoon. At least once a month, the Press Club sponsors a forum that we think will be of interest to our members and to the community at large. You do not have to be a Press Club member to attend. The forums are open to everyone. The two panelists today do not need much introduction. As alternating columnists, they are on the front page of the Midland section of the Omaha World Herald every day. They are, in alphabetical order, Mike Kelly and Rainbow Rowell. Mike joined the World Herald as a local news reporter in 1970. In 1981, he became the paper's sports editor and sports columnist, and in 1991, he began his current column. Rainbow became a regular columnist in 1996 after 6 months covering Western Iowa for the World Herald. They have agreed to come here today to talk about the business of column writing, how they do their jobs, where they get their ideas, and so forth. And while they are speaking, we would like you to be writing your questions for them. I'm going to ask Mike Kelly to come up here first. Mike?
Thank you very much. And Rainbow, you remember back in the 70s when I was covering City Hall. Oh, that's right, you weren't born yet.
I think I interviewed you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for inviting my colleague Rainbow Rowell and me to this Omaha Press Club Forum. It's a beautiful snow day. Somehow that seems appropriate for a couple of columnists who are, you know, often accused of trying to snow our readers. Well, Rainbow is very unusual in the newspaper business and becoming a columnist nearly 5 years ago at age 24. 24. I have column ideas more than 24 years old. I have a very common name, Mike Kelly. I think there are 25 of us in the Omaha phone book. And so I've always envied Rainbow, her distinctive byline. Rainbow sounds so cool and kind of new age. For a while, I thought very seriously of changing my byline to Moonbeam. Rainbow replaced the popular and beloved Robert McMorris on his retirement, and she regularly gives us so much of what I think we need, including a lively, youthful voice and a woman's voice. She's a fine craftsman with the language, and she displays a talent that's rare, writing about serious topics with humor and a sometimes biting cleverness, such as yesterday's piece about SUVs, in which she says no one really believes driving a Ford Expedition makes you a terrorist, but we also don't believe that SUVs run on Kool-Aid and spit cotton candy through their exhaust pipes. When my daughter Bridget was a teenager, I saw her reading the Sunday paper one day and chuckling, and I asked her what she was reading, and she said, Dave Barry. And then she said, geez, Dad, if you could only write like this. Writing four columns a week, as I do, certainly isn't brain surgery, but you have to stay on top of it and keep cranking. In his later years, my dear old dad asked, Mike, how many columns a week do you write? I said, four, Dad. He says, what do you do on the other day? I barely get four done. Sometimes the deadline bears down on you and you fear you'll write something really stupid or come up totally dry. The late Southern columnist Louis Grizzard told of being approached in a lounge by a woman who said in a sulky voice, I'll do anything for $100. He said, anything? Well, here's $100 and here's my room key. Go write my column. Our fine sports columnist Tom Chattel says the great thing about writing a column is that it's different things on different days, and that's true. Some days it's indignant, some days it's funny, some days it's heavy, sometimes it's light. Sometimes it carries a strong point of view, sometimes it tells a story. But it should always, I think, somehow say something about the community and the times in which we live. And there are surely different kinds of columns. The kind we write and that many other local columnists around the country write are not punditry. They are not op-ed page columns, although I was pleased to see the column by George Will on the op-ed page of today's World Herald. I'm not a movie reviewer, but I had written on Sunday about reviewers from around the country who watched the excellent movie About Schmidt, which was filmed in Omaha, and use it as an occasion to bash Omaha as bleak, drab, and soulless. Well, I deplored the arrogance, ignorance, and intellectual dishonesty of that, and noted that the themes that Alexander Payne, the director, explores in the movie, including artificiality and self-doubt, are universal, not limited to Omaha or Nebraska or the Midwest. They're at least as old as Thoreau's famous statement that the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. Well, George Will today says, you should see the movie and decide for yourself if it isn't another exercise in condescension. He said the haunting sense of regret about time wasted is a timeless theme of literature. Timeless, placeless, part of the human condition, not a Midwestern affliction. Well, he said it better than I, but I'm glad he said what I said. After I wrote my column on that topic Friday night, I read it to my wife, Barb, and, you know, waited for her to say, hey, honey, that's really good. She listened for a second, and she said, it's pretty defensive. I said, yeah, what's your point? Our news columns in the World Herald certainly can express opinion, but they are not designed as mini editorial pages. We do not take positions on legislative bills, for example, or endorse candidates. That doesn't mean we can't write about legislative issues or candidates, as we both have done, finding angles that explain, elucidate, or humanize. As Hugh Cowden said, before I wrote my current column, I spent 10 years as sports editor and sports columnist, a time, I guess, when I was considered more controversial. Tom Osborne once told me I had antipathy for the football program. And when I looked that up, I saw that was not a compliment. Twice I was introduced in public, once at Rosenblatt Stadium and once at Exarban Coliseum, and I was roundly booed. We receive lots of feedback, one of the nice things of the job. In sports, one of the letters to me started out, Dear Rat Face. But one of my favorites was from a man who wrote about one of my sports columns, there you go picking on Tom Osborne again. Don't you know that Husker football is the greatest thing that's ever happened to this country? And that Tom Osborne is the greatest coach since Vince Lombardo. Occasionally, in sports or news, we write columns that are personal, which is to say, we write about ourselves. In those cases, we must always be careful to be sure we're writing about universal themes. A few weeks ago, I wrote about a woman whom I didn't know, but who had left me a plaintive phone message saying, please call, I need help. By the time I called back, there was no answer. That night she hanged herself. She was mentally ill, and her sister said the woman for years had resisted help. And yet I'll always be haunted by the fact that a woman who resisted help on the day of her suicide called me for help. Until the past half year, the column that received the most response of anything I've written was about Reggie Abernathy, whom I never knew, but who was born the day before me. The significance was that in our senior year in college, when the draft lottery was held during the Vietnam War, his birthday drew number 7, and mine drew number 264. I moved on with my life. Reggie was killed in Vietnam on March 22, 1971. But nothing I have written has received near the response as my columns on my daughter, Bridget, who was abducted, raped, shot 3 times, and left for dead on June 21st. She has returned to teaching, but now as a result of the stress of her near death, she's been diagnosed with type 1 juvenile diabetes. She'll make her first trip back to Omaha since the attack when she comes the weekend of February 7th and 8th. Bridget is 25, and she'll speak at her high school, Duchenne Academy, and be honored at the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation banquet on February 8th. I wish I never had to write about such a horrible thing as her ordeal, of course, but it happened, and she's making a difference by speaking out against the stigma and the secrecy of rape. Most days, though, column writing is enjoyable. It's fun to poke fun when a public official, for example, the Papillion City Administrator, negotiates a contract that prohibits anyone in city government from criticizing him. Even in sadness, sometimes there's humor, such as the funeral of Claire Oswald, who often was confused with the College of St. Mary professor, Claire Oswald, and one of the professor's friends showed up at the funeral, surprised to see his old friend looking hale and hearty. The local column is one of the ways any newspaper makes a personal connection with its readers, and I am honored to be one of the columnists of the Omaha World Herald.
Thank you, Mike. Now I'll invite Rainbow Rowell up here for her to tell us what her life is like, at least professionally.
Well, I was going to start by reminding everyone that I get paid to write, not to speak. But then Mike came up and did such a nice job that I don't even have that excuse. I've been writing a column off and on since I was 16 years old. My first column was for the Omaha North Star. It had a name. It was called Of Cabbages and Kings, and it was really dreadful. I would write really deep things about how the world too dearly loved a cage, and, you know, also that there was far too much hugging and holding hands in the North High hallways. So it was very self-important and pretty awful. But it got into my blood, and when I went on to college, I wrote for the Daily Nebraskan. And my senior year of college, I had three majors. I was thinking about going into advertising or perhaps some literature writing teaching type thing. And the thing that kept me with journalism is I thought, well, if I go into advertising, I'm never going to write a column. And once you have a voice, like the voice that's given to you in a column, it's very difficult to give up. I think that it's increasingly challenging to be heard in our culture and in our community. The more opportunities that people have to express themselves through the internet and other forms of media, the more of a cacophony I think there is. There's all of these people clamoring to be heard, and writing a column in a newspaper is a very, it's such a privilege, and it's a way of sort of cutting through the clamor and expressing yourself and making a connection to your reader. And I think that's addictive. So writing a column and hoping that someday I would be able to write a column was definitely a major reason I stayed in journalism. Bob McMorris announced that he would retire about 6 months after I started at the Omaha World Herald. And I'd grown up reading Bob and thought, wow, that'd be a great job. I'm never going to get that job, ever. In fact, 6 months I worked for the Iowa edition, which means that Omaha readers often didn't get to read my stories at all. My mother, a few months after I started at the World Herald, okay, that's not me knocking, sorry. I had to stand still for a second and see, wait, what is that? Okay. About 6 months after I started, my mom said, or a few months after I started, she said, so when are you going to get a story in the paper? And I had to explain, I'm in the Iowa edition. In fact, after I got my job as columnist, someone came over from the editorial section to welcome me to the newspaper. So I applied for this job thinking that Bob was retiring, Mike had a good thing going, he wasn't going anywhere, I thought. He's got a great job. So I thought, if I ever want to be a columnist at the World Herald, I need to apply now. And I was really, it took them 6 months to make that decision, and I was shocked when I got this job. I thought, surely this room is full of people better qualified than I am to write a column. I must be really good. That's what I thought. I must be great. They picked me. And I shortly realized that there were plenty of people in the room who were qualified, more qualified to write the column, and they just hadn't applied for the job because they didn't want it. So everyone, I always tell classrooms when I talk to students, you know, everyone in this room could write a column for 2 weeks, maybe a better column than the one I'm writing, frankly, because we have all of us have ideas that we carry around with us and think, boy, I'd just like to, if I had a soapbox, I'd go off on this. And then after that week or so is over, you realize what it means to be a columnist. Because the difference between being a columnist and being a reporter is that you don't ever get an off day as a columnist. I remember being a reporter and having days where I would say to my editor, oh, there's nothing going on in Western Iowa today. Talk to me next week. As a columnist, my editor will walk by and say, so what have you got for tomorrow? And I'll say, nothing. And he'll say, well, I'll see you at 4:30 when you turn that in, because yeah, there's just no escape. So I realized that the most challenging part of my job was going to be finding ideas. What I've tried to do, and I think what Mike Kelly and what Bob McMorris excelled at connecting with Omaha readers and finding stories that people respond to in a very direct way, you know, stories that make people laugh, stories that touch you, stories that surprise you. Bob McMorris's column was not the most important news of the day, but it was, it really reached people and touched people and made them laugh and made a connection. So I try to write columns or find column ideas. I'm always working to find columns, the sort of columns that if the ideas that I take home and I tell my husband or that I tell my mother, often you'll cover a city council meeting, and the news of the day is not the news that you go home to tell someone about. You know, maybe a very important decision was made, but what you really want to tell people is that one of the city council members fell asleep. So I try to think, what's the real story? Not necessarily what's the most important story. The other adjustment for me as a columnist is that I'm the sort of person who wants everyone to like me. And in fact, in college, if I think the two people who wrote me really nasty letters in college, I found their telephone numbers, and I called each of them. And I stayed on the phone until they admitted that I was much nicer than they had ever expected. Well, I can't do that now because I would spend all of my time on the phone. Something I had to get over was it's not important, really, for anyone to like me. That's not my job. It's not to be liked. When I started, I wrote a story about growing up poor. Sorry, I can't master that P sound. Oh, wait, I just did. Sorry. Anyway, growing up poor. And people had really strong reaction to that story, and some of it was very, very, very negative. And there were letters day after day in the Public Pulse. And my mother called and said, "Are you going to get fired?" And I said, "No. No, they don't care. My boss does not care if anyone likes me. In fact, I think he's taking wicked delight that so many people hate me, because that means that those people are reading. The very worst thing that I can be is boring. And I had one woman who was probably my biggest fan the first year and a half that I wrote a column. She lived in Hamburg, Iowa, and she would write me every other week or so, and her letters always started, "Dear Rainbow," which I thought was very informal for someone who hated me as much as she did. "Dear Rainbow, I read your column every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I don't miss one. I've read everything you've ever written, and they're all terrible. I am sending this letter, as always, to your editor, signed, Mrs. Meanie Pants in Hamburg, Iowa." And I would look at these letters and think, I hope you are sending them to my editor, because the only part he will ever see is, I read your column every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So I think that's the challenge for me now, as I no longer have the excuse of saying, well, I just started. You know, it's been 5 years since I started doing this. To continue to connect to people and to continue to make them think and make, you know, and start conversations and help people and think and react and respond and get people talking. I really feel like that's my job. So thank you.
Rainbow is probably the first person I ever asked a resume from and she replied, "I don't have one. I've never needed one because this is my first job." Here are some questions. Do you think writing a column opens doors for you that are not open to other reporters?
Yes.
Yes. You know, when, you know, they put your mug there. I always say when you lay out the paper, that's where your coffee mug goes on the mug. But there's no doubt about it. When you get to write a column, number one, it's a more personal way of writing a lot of ways, and people start to feel like they know you. And, boy, that's a great benefit, because I think Rainbow would agree. We both get a lot of calls and suggestions, notes from people with story ideas. I mean, we get a lot more ideas sent in than we could ever use. Occasionally, we even think up one by ourselves. But, yeah, definitely it's
only
a benefit.
I think, too, when I was a reporter, all of my conversations started with, "This is Rainbow Rowell from the Omaha World Herald." "Ringo? No, Rainbow." "What? What? Who? What?" And I've become really spoiled now, because it gets you in the door with people. They feel like they know you. Mike and I, a number of times, have been able to get stories that other reporters at the World Herald were not able to get, because when a reporter calls you, it's this unknown person. You don't know what their intentions are. You don't know if you can trust them with your story. And I think when one of us calls someone, if they've read our column, they feel like they know how we would handle it, and they feel like they can trust us. We have a personality to them. I suppose it could work the other way, too, but it usually works in our favor.
Rainbow, this is a question for you. Did you have to submit several sample columns?
Yes, I did. I submitted six columns, I think, though, that what really got me the job was not the columns that I submitted, but the work that I was doing in Western Iowa. I was having a lot of fun finding really weird people to write about in Western Iowa, and I think that what I think they wanted was to make sure that someone wasn't going to get in this position and then run out of steam. And I'd had some consistency finding goofy stories in Western Iowa. And I think that's what got me the job, not my sample columns.
And there was actually quite a competition at that time. I think there were at least, 17 applicants for the job. And I was very glad that they didn't make me apply over and, finish in the top two. So it was, Rainbow won the competition fair and square.
Well, they took a lot of time to decide.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, talk about the difficult, and I assume, difficult decision-making process to write about Bridget's terrible ordeal.
Just the other night, Bridget and I had a great long conversation on the phone preparing for her trip back when she's going to speak, and she said to me, "Did you know right away when this happened that you would write about it?" And I told her, not at all. You're just, remember driving out Abbott Drive, I was riding out, Steve Jordan here was with me and flew down with me, stayed, and Deanna Sands, our managing editor, was driving, and I was writing out notes for them to have information for the news story for the next day. It wasn't until a few days later, Bridget still couldn't speak because of the tubes in her mouth and everywhere else. And we were talking about the news coverage, and as you know, most news outlets have a policy of not naming rape victims or rape survivors. And we were talking about that, and she wrote, "It's okay if they say rape." And then she wrote the line that I've quoted and repeated many times, "Why is it more shameful to be a rape victim than a gunshot victim?" And that comment, not only have I used it, it's been picked up in papers around the country, quoting Bridget. That was the moment, I think, when I thought, we're going to write about this at some point. And it didn't just happen right away. It took an executive decision by the World Herald to make an exception to our policy, because even if someone who has been raped wants her or his name used, we still, under our policy, will not use it. Yes, it was difficult, but I guess I was just so inspired by Bridget and her strength, and seeing the real deep truth of what she was asking in that question, that I thought that this is something that needed to be talked about. And the reaction that we have received, not only in our area but around the country, has really been amazing and pretty wonderful.
Have there been any actual changes in newspaper policy around the country?
There have been, I don't know, but there has been a lot of discussion, including a seminar at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida, which I attended in October. It was on rape in the news media, because Bridget's attack, of course, isn't the only one that has gotten a lot of attention in the past year. There were children, the two teenagers in California that were abducted, and then it turned out that they were raped. So there's been a lot of discussion about this, and I think it's there are about 30% of the papers probably who will use the person's name if she wants it to be used. Others
others still will not. So I think it's evolving. It's been a long time in which the prevailing thought has been that a woman is damaged goods. I actually had a guy say that on an MSNBC program that I was on. As I said, luckily we were in different cities or I would have damaged his nose.
Yeah.
But, you know, putting – and I think the younger generation of women definitely have already put this behind them. They don't see any stigma. You know, Bridget never thought for a minute that she was in any way to blame for this, and, of course, she was not.
This is for both of you. What do you do when you come up dry for a column idea, or does that not happen to you?
Well, there are always column ideas. There are often very bad column ideas. You know, there's always a list. I think it's how deep you go into your list. And sometimes story ideas will surprise you. You'll think that something isn't that interesting or is sort of cliched, and once you start working on it, you'll find that. Maybe I'm just easily interested, but I always seem to, oh, you know, this isn't as bad as I thought, or this person is much more interesting than I thought. And then some days you just have nothing, and you write something and you just want to get it behind you.
I would just agree with that. You just, some days you just never know. My dad always used to say, don't you have one already written and on the shelf? Well, that could be done because, you know, not every column is timely. It's good when you can have a number of them, you know, relating to the news and things that are happening right now, but some are just good stories that can be told just about any time. One advantage of having one on the shelf ready to go would be you could go try something else that might or might not work, and if it doesn't work, okay, you've got this other one. I've been writing a column for 21 years now. I've never had one in the bank. You're just always writing on deadline.
Rainbow, what columns have you gotten the most reaction from?
The one that I mentioned earlier about kind of what happens to your head when you grow up really poor and how you sort of never get over that or get past it, maybe. I don't know. But that definitely got the most. Also, really ordinary ideas. I remember trying to convince my editor that I was going to write about the baker's card, and I don't think she thought that was... It seemed sort of frivolous. I was going to write about how I hate the baker's card, and I've just had it up to here with the baker's card. And I looked on the website that day, and there were more than 50 replies to that column. People just were choking on their own bile talking about the baker's card. And so probably a combination of the very deep and the very shallow.
And one great thing about that is I'll bet Rainbow never thought for a second, which she should not, that Baker's was one of our biggest advertisers. And people would think, can I write something that maybe Nebraska Furniture Mart wouldn't look good? I mean, we have to use the same standards of fairness with everybody. Did you even think about that?
No, someone else raised it, and then I called.
But you wrote it anyway.
Yeah, and I called and talked to someone from Baker's at the time and you know, and I said, oh, this is what so-and-so from Baker's says to explain why they have the Baker's card. People still hate it.
This is along the same lines for Rainbow. You were very critical of the French after a visit there.
Zut alors.
I talked to people who thought you were too critical. What kind of reaction did you get?
Oh, all kinds of reaction. It amazes me how critical people will be and how loose they will be just in talking. Oh, did you go to France? I went to France. It was terrible. You know, this. And yet they expect you to be so careful in your column. I think people expect they expect us to be very formal and careful and to, you know, really watch every word. Or they'll say to you, oh, I hated it too, but I would never say that out loud, you know, or I'd never say that in the paper. I thought I was just sort of, I went on vacation and here's what I thought. Boy, you would not believe how miserable we were in France. And I took 5 years of French in high school, so I didn't go in there, you know, as the absolute worst ugly American. But what I have found, tips for going to France, after all of the feedback that I got, the people who enjoyed France the most were obscenely rich and ate in all the best restaurants and stayed in all the best hotels. And then there were the people who were coming up to me saying, Oh, yeah, it was really bad. Were people like me who rode the Metro and stayed wherever they could afford. I have never come so close to being physically attacked as I was over that column. I was in the Underground outside a certain French restaurant, and one of the waiters came up to me and said, you know, you are the one from the paper who hates my country. And he was just, could hardly restrain himself. He kept dodging into my face. And he wasn't even from Paris, I'd like to say.
And what French restaurant was that?
I don't know. It's a very good French restaurant. Delicious. I wasn't actually eating there. I was walking by.
For both of you, do editors ever tell you what you can or cannot write?
Rainbow, I think, had an experience after the fact.
Thanks,
recently.
Mike. I have very few rules. Sometimes it's hard to tell when your editor is telling you what they think, whether or not it's a rule or just his or her opinion. Recently I wrote a column and I don't really want to talk about it specifically because I...
Sorry.
Well, no. Yeah. Thank you, Mike. It's still kind of a foggy situation to me. When I was hired, they told me, look, we don't fire columns, we fire columnists. So go out and write what you want, and we get sick of you, we'll fire you. And with some warning, I hope. But
I'm sorry I mentioned that. Without saying what it was, it related to what I said about, and correct me if I'm wrong, about that area where you get close to endorsing, like, legislative bills or candidates or issues. It was a very good column.
Well, and it's tricky with the editorial section because I try not to let what's in the editorial section affect what I write in my column. But as an editor pointed out, if you disagree with the editorial section all the time, it seems like you're feuding with them. And if you always agree with what they say, we seem like we're all in cahoots. So it was an issue of, does a column echo too much what was already said in an editorial? And it was good because we had a good conversation about it. But in general, I think our editors want us to feel free to roam and to write about anything and not to have these false barriers in our head that you can't write about this and you can't write about that.
And they're good about saying when they have an idea that it's just an idea. Even Larry King, the executive editor, the top guy, here's an idea. Use it or don't, and so they're very good. I mean, I don't feel like we're restricted at all.
No, and they'll say sometimes, "Oh, I didn't like that," and my response is that you, for example, Larry King didn't like that, or is that you, my boss, didn't like that? You know, and he will usually say, "Nah, it's just my personal opinion."
Do you ever excuse me? Do you ever feel compelled to, after you've written one, to submit it to the editors for their reaction?
Well, of course, every column is submitted to the editors for the reaction, and more than one editor, more like three or four people, will read it. And I always say, and I've got a great editor, Ann Henderson, and I always say that one of the best things Ann does is keeps me from embarrassing myself. Mm-hmm. But you mean like submit the idea?
Yeah,
in advance. No. And I have friends at other papers who kind of have that. They need to tell their editor what they're writing about, and they say, oh, I don't know. But, you know, I don't even know myself, and I think Rainbow alluded to this. When you start writing, sometimes you think it's going to be pretty good, and it's not, and then vice versa. Sometimes it develops and turns into a pretty good piece.
I have an editor who has a really short attention span, and his first response is often, oh, who cares, or that's boring. And so I find that he's usually wrong, but I find that in trying to sell him on this, that it helps me. It helps me make my case and really think through the column and think, well, no, this is interesting for this reason, this reason, this reason, this reason, this reason, and just because you don't care doesn't mean mm-hmm. everyone else doesn't, you know, so.
This is related. Does the World Herald need a pure political columnist? We hear more opinion about football than we do about government.
Good question. I think it would be very interesting to have kind of an edgy political columnist. And, you know, maybe on the op-ed page, maybe not. You know, some papers have columnists like that just on their local news page. I'd enjoy reading it.
And some of the columnists who end up on our op-ed page do not run in the op-ed sections of their hometown papers. So,
Rainbow, do you think your age had anything to do with your selection as a columnist? The World Herald's search for younger readers. That's come up sometimes when your column is talked about. The World Herald made the decision in order to attract younger readers because most newspapers are trying to do that.
Well, it's no secret that we can use all the younger readers that we can get. I think the World Herald was more interested in getting a woman. I mean, if anything was an unfair advantage to me, it was probably that I'm a woman, not that I was young or am young. I think that there had never been a woman writing this sort of column for the World Herald, and that I think they were hoping that I would maybe write about more younger skewing topics, but it was made very clear to me that my audience was not people my own age, that I was not to be writing columns that, like columns I wrote for my college newspaper, where I could assume that pretty much everyone who was reading them would be around my age. I mean, when I was hired, I was told, you know, think that this is a very general audience of different types of people in different ages. And in my column, I definitely want most of the ideas to be very general. That's who we are as the newspaper, and that's who our audience is. But if I can draw younger readers who maybe wouldn't be reading the newspaper, who feel like the newspaper is not meant for them, then great.
Mike, how would you compare your present role as columnist with your earlier assignments? That is, like the courthouse beat. Were you on the courthouse?
You know, yes.
Were any previous assignments good preparation to be a columnist?
Absolutely. I think one of the best things today, I feel like, you know, I'm 54. I feel like I'm the prime of my career. I think the best thing going for me is I've had such a background. I mean, I covered police, courts, city hall, I've done tax stories, human interest stories, 10 years as not only sports columnist, but also sports editor in charge of the section. And I think all of that, I feel like I've met a lot of people, not only in Omaha, but around the region. So I think all of them have contributed. And, I've liked every job that I've had. I mean, I loved covering City Hall. Some people might think that wasn't fun. That's the level of government that's closest to the people. I did that for about 5 years, mainly when Ed Zirinsky was mayor. So the first question was how to compare it. My last job was two jobs, sports editor and sports columnist. Today, Tom Chattel is the sports columnist, and Steve Sinclair is the sports editor. I never thought I could get my hands or get my arms around those two jobs. That was a tough 10 years just in that sense, you know, trying to manage a department of 25 people plus writing four columns a week. Not saying it wasn't fun at times, and it was surely interesting. But boy, I like it now that I just am responsible for writing the column.
Do the two of you consult with each other on topics before you write them in order to avoid overlapping?
We don't really have to. Early on, we thought this would be an issue, and the example that came to us when we were talking about this week was, there was an incident at Henry Dorley Zoo where a child threw a clod of dirt at the alligator, was it?
The little brat.
Yeah.
No,
I'm
just kidding.
And
Rainbow took his side.
No, I did not take his side. And Dr. Simmons held on to the kid until the police got here. There, I think. It's been a while since we wrote about it, but that was the gist. And we both came in the next day saying, I'm going to write about the zoo. And we kind of decided at the same time, and there was this little scuffle of, well, we can't both write the same column. And then we realized that Mike thought that Dr. Simmons was well within his rights to do what he did, and I thought he overstepped his bounds. And so we went, well, okay. And we don't. We're usually not warring, but we usually have a different take.
We should all probably do that more often because it was kind of nice. I mean, your approach, as I recall, was okay. He shouldn't have done it, but do not touch my kid
right
under any circumstance. And my take was he didn't strike the child, took the child by the wrist, and then, you know, the mother wants to sue or something like that. But when I was in sports, we did one time, Lee Barfnick and I wrote like opposite position columns on something. I think it's very effective, and it's probably something we ought to maybe even think about trying to do sometimes.
I can think of only one circumstance where I had been working on a column and Mike had the same idea and got to it first, and that, you know, is bound to happen for 5 years.
excuse me. Mike, it seems your column always has a strong finishing statement. Do you have that in mind when you start, or does it come to you as you write?
I always have in mind that I want to finish very strongly, but I don't usually have the ending in mind at the beginning. There's one theory of writing is that you figure out the beginning, and then you figure out the ending, and then you figure out how to get from the beginning to the ending. And I think that's a very good theory, and it's not one that I use in practice. I think a strong ending, you know, really just gives, I mean, you want that thump at the end, and you want the reader to have that feeling of kind of closing the loop.
There's this theory, too, the inverted pyramid style that we learn in journalism school, to put the most important thing first and then trail off to the least important so that the editor can just cut from the bottom. I think as columnists, we know exactly how long our column has to be. And I like that when I'm reading Mike's column that he has the confidence I'm going to get to the end, you know, and he's left something there for me.
Do you sometimes, for fun, write a column that you don't really believe just to get a rise out of people?
I've never done that, and I've read columns that I know that's exactly what happened, and I'm thinking mainly of some of these Wiseacre sports columns that I've read, and I detest that kind of writing. I think it's insulting to readers, and no, I've never written something I didn't believe.
That's sort of the equivalent of the really outrageous talk radio to me, just saying something loud and obnoxious just to keep people interested. And I think that shows that you're not confident in who you are and what your viewpoint is, that you have to try and get a rise out of people.
I've certainly written some things that after I wrote them, I wished I hadn't written them because I thought they were kind of stupid the next day. But
how often does that happen?
More often than I like to admit, I guess.
Has either of you ever written a book? Is it a goal that you would like to do someday?
I bet Rainbow's got a great novel in her.
And yet it's not the one that I'm writing. I'd told myself, I've always wanted to write a novel, and I had always told myself that I would someday do some fiction writing, and I never did, because we even bought an iMac a couple of years ago, and that was going to be my fiction writing computer. And I found that I am such a trained dog that if there's not someone standing over me going, I need that by 4, I don't do anything. So in the last year, I've been giving myself deadlines. And frankly, it's not very good what I'm writing. But what I think it has done is make me a better column writer, because I think as writers you get into the habit of writing the same thing day after day to the very, not the same thing, but the same type of thing, the very same length, the very same voice. And for me, it's been a really helpful to try out other voices, and I think it's livened up my column. Who knows?
I haven't written a book. Quite a number of people have urged me to write a book in conjunction with Bridget about what's happening, because there's so many there are a lot of interesting angles and layers to it aside from the dramatic life and death story. If we do that, I think we're going to let some time pass before we get into that.
I wanted to follow up on that. What columnists do you read? Do you have favorite columnists, either of you?
Rainbow Rowell and Tom Chattel. I don't know.
I read columnists, but I don't feel as inspired by columnists as I do by other sorts of writers. And I think that if you read a lot of columnists, you find that we can all start to sound alike. And I don't want to sound more like a columnist. I want to sound more like I can't quite explain it, but I find myself being more inspired by fiction writers or even magazine writers because it's so different from what I do that I feel like it challenges me to try new things.
I do like a lot of them on the op-ed page. Leonard Pitts from the Miami Herald is a wonderful writer and, of course, probably the premier columnist going today. I think he's got a couple Pulitzer Prizes behind him. Is Thomas Friedman is the New York Times. He is not only a columnist of the Times, he is a columnist for our Times. I mean, he's brilliant and he's a good reporter. And that's something we haven't talked about too much today. I mean, it's important for us as columnists to be good reporters. You know, there's sometimes you can just write an essay and it might not be too bad, but for the most part, I think you want to get people in your stories, you want to be getting other viewpoints and, you know, kind of give more of a wholeness to what you're writing.
They say good news does not sell papers. Are your columns proof that that adage is not true?
I don't think our columns are always about good news. I certainly don't feel like our columns are Pollyanna or anything like that. Could they be edgier sometimes? I don't know. What do you think, Randall?
I think that people remember bad stories better than they remember good stories. And people will begin their story pitches to me. They'll call and say, I think you should write about this. And there just is no one ever writes about anything good in the newspaper. There's never anything happy in the newspaper. And I think, well, that's not true. I'm writing about nice people all the time. I think it's our perception that it's what sticks with you and what you remember are sometimes the most shocking, terrible stories.
I've heard it at least 1,000 times. People say the newspaper never carries anything good about young people. Mm-hmm. Come on. I mean, for one thing, start with the sports section. Every day and for decades and decades, the World Herald has written great affirming stories about young people doing good things. Now, today there was a good story about one school being, a high school being investigated for violating the sportsmanship rules. You know, that's a story that needs to be in the paper as well. But in the news sections as well, it seems to me like, I had one today, kind of a good human interest story about a young man who was stricken at Westside Middle School. I think we've got a responsibility to do all those kinds of stories too, but I agree with Rainbow. For whatever reason, people seem like they don't remember.
Here's one I don't think we've touched upon. What kind of feedback do you get from people that you write about? Well, how much is positive and how much is negative?
I get almost no feedback from people that I write about. I don't know about you, Mike, but I think that it's interesting because you forge this really intimate relationship with this person in a few hours when you're interviewing them, and they'll tell you anything, and you feel very close to that person. And then I think it's maybe because of the intimacy and because it's such a strange intimacy, you just sort of move along after that. I'll get a note, but it's very strange. It's like you make these friends then. And
that's a very interesting point, I think. Because for like an hour or two or whatever, when people allow you into their lives, and we have the privilege of asking people questions that you would never ask them in a social setting, and often they will open up to you, and we appreciate that and try to write good stories about that. And then the next day you're on to the next column and the next one. And I've had people come up to me, and I'm glad that they remember this column is something that was very important in their lives, and they'll come up to me and say, "Hi, don't you remember me?" And it was like 8 years ago that I wrote about them, and I say, "Help me." And then in almost every case, when they remind me, I'll certainly remember it. But I would say, I think I get a lot of nice feedback, occasionally some negative feedback from people. But a story that I got to do recently, I was really happy to get to do it, was one where the people had been private for 15 years about what happened and never wanted to talk. And you always love when you can tell a story like that. And this was Andrew and Alex Olson, the conjoined or Siamese twins that were born at the Med Center almost 16 years ago now. They lived conjoined for the first 13 months of their lives up in Elk Point, South Dakota, just a couple hours from here. At the time of this historic operation, the only time ever in Nebraska that this operation has occurred, 21 hours, 15 surgeons, the family did not want their names used, and they were not. And then they went back, and the boys have grown up in this town. And what happened was the mom made a call to a physician down here, one of the surgeons who has since retired, and had a question. And he said, well, bring the boys down. I haven't seen them in years. I'd like to see them. Sometimes, and I think there's some good public relations people here today, and, you know, sometimes our goals don't always mesh, but a lot of times good public relations people are so helpful. And this was a case where that happened. Tom O'Connor from the Med Center, he heard about this. He knew I'd be interested. He really ran interference in that case, spoke to the mom, and she was very reluctant. But just to shorten the story, I see we have some other questions. She eventually relented and went up and spent a good part of the day. And Kent Sievers took some wonderful pictures, and we ran the story on Christmas Day. And those are the kind, as a writer, you just especially love getting to tell those kinds of stories.
One more note about feedback from people that you write about. I think that if you do your job and really understand to the best of your ability someone's point of view and really do your reporting and spend a lot of time or as much time as possible with that person, you can present them in sometimes even an unflattering light. But if it's a true light, they still are glad that you... I've written about one person in particular who it was a very frank story, and it didn't make him look great, but he still really liked it because it wasn't untrue or false.
This is somewhat related. What percent of your columns comes from people initiating contact with you, and what percent comes from you initiating contact with other people?
I don't know. Half and half?
I'd say probably a little less, maybe a third of mine come from people who call.
I'd say probably about a half of mine.
Uh-huh. Are there columns that you have written that surprised you from the reaction that they've gotten?
Yes. Can you think of any, though, Mike?
I'm thinking back to my sports days. I remember one that the hockey teams were fighting and raising sticks and hitting each other, and the police chief was in the stands, and he wrote a letter to the general managers of both teams saying that Exarban Coliseum was in his jurisdiction, and the next time he saw athletes swinging those heavy sticks, he was going to have them arrested for assault and battery. And people who are hockey fans have seen this kind of thing go on for years. And the Lancers at that time had a group, which I pointed out in a column, in which I championed what the police chief was doing and said it was time somebody said this. There was a group called the Red Ice Rooters. Any of you Lancer fans, you know what that, you know, blood on the ice? And I was surprised at the vehemence of the negative reaction I got to that.
I was surprised when I wrote, shortly after September 11th, I wrote about a speech that George W. Bush gave that I thought was really a fantastic speech. And I'd been the opposite of a fan of the president. I'd been sort of, just didn't like him and was really moved by this speech. And it sort of, after listening to the speech, I felt like I needed to maybe clean the slate for the president and so I wrote this, and I thought that I was saying, that was a great speech, and I, you know, maybe I need to be have more confidence in the president right now. But I just admitting that I didn't like him before, or people were very, very, very angry and thought that it was very disrespectful to write that way after September 11th. And that response was so chilling to me that I think I really avoided any topic that went anywhere near the president for a few months. And then after those few months were over, I felt guilty about that because I thought in the times after September 11th, that's when we needed to be speaking most from our heart and most frankly, and that I shouldn't have let myself be intimidated by that response.
Well, you had a good column coming back from that about Senator Hagel, right, who was raising questions early on about Iraq and whether we should be, you know, starting a war over there. And you wrote a column sort of championing.
People were criticizing him for saying he shouldn't criticize the president, you know, that we don't have a right. The undertone was that you don't have a right to do this, which I think is scary.
Do you two write at home or do you write at the paper?
I write some at home, mostly at the paper. I like being in the sort of the milieu there. You probably know that Rainbow and I both have opulent corner offices. we have cubicles, you know, right with everybody else, and that's as it should be. I like being in the, you know, kind of Grand Central Station. I mean, you get used to writing with a lot of noise around. But, you know, do you find this true? I mean, you get ideas sometimes just by talking to colleagues.
Right.
We've got a lot of really smart, interesting, funny people on the staff, and they're a great resource.
I think our editors want us in the newsroom. Probably if I had my druthers, I would write more at home because I do. I'm a night person, and I come up with some of what I perceive are my best ideas at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'll jot them down. And I would like to sometimes have the computer at home so that I could be.
Tom Chattel rarely writes in the office.
Right.
He's usually out somewhere. Paulie's, I think. No, not really. Just kidding.
Rainbow, how would you voice your experience of being in the Omaha Press Club show last year?
But that's interesting. Mike and I were talking about this earlier. It was fun, but I didn't like delivering someone else's punchlines. Maybe I'm too accustomed to saying what I want to say because it was scripted. And I got a big laugh, but I felt really no connection to that laugh because I was like, I didn't write that, you know.
But you delivered it.
Oh,
so
whatever.
Well. I was encouraging Rainbow to write some things for the show. She's a very witty writer.
Yeah, but it's nerve-wracking. It's very being in front of all the people like that is so intimidating.
Mike, you're going to be MC again, right?
Yes, March 28th and 29th. Hope everybody's there.
I have a really heavy philosophical question here. Well, it is. Does the and you have a couple of minutes. Does the employee ownership of the World Herald show up in any differences you know with other city newspapers?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think the fact that the World Herald is employee-owned, and maybe this sounds self-serving to say this, I think it's a benefit to our community. Des Moines Register has always enjoyed a good reputation, a pretty good newspaper, and they're owned out of Reston, Virginia, I believe, as are a lot of newspapers around the country. Nothing intrinsically wrong with that, but I think it's a benefit that everybody who is a little part owner of the World Herald lives in this community, and this community is important to us. And if you have a gripe, even if you want to talk to John Gottschalk, call 444-1000 and ask for his office, and you'll eventually get to him, if not right away. So, yeah, I think it's a big benefit to have that local ownership.
I think we're about out of time. I want to thank Mike Kelly and Rainbow Rowell for taking the time to participate in this month's forum and for enlightening us on the fascinating business of column writing. And our thanks as well to you, our audience here at the Omaha Press Club, and to our KIOS radio audience. We are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's guests were Omaha World Herald columnists Mike Kelly and Rainbow Rowell. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, January 16th, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Hugh Cowden for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be on Thursday, February 20th at 12 noon. The guest speaker will be World Herald writer Tom Allen. He'll be talking about his latest book. If you'd like to attend this or other future forums, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.